Chapter 22, The Rescue. "He's already struck," gasped Dodd as the light of his candle flickered against a distant backdrop of rubble. No wonder Czerny and Jib felt pressure to leave in a hurry. Dodd moved quickly down the hall to where twisted beams and rocks blocked one of the side corridors. The ceiling and walls had collapsed, completely filling the entrance and spilling over into the larger passageway. Halfway up the pile of debris, Boots' bag was positioned just as Dodd had seen it in his mind, or so he thought. When he climbed the wreckage to have a closer look, the bag was empty, and it wasn't Boots. "Hello!" shouted Dodd. "Is anyone in there?" This time, instead of hearing an echo, he completely tuned his ears to the faint cry for help coming from behind the barricade. "I'll get you out, don't worry," yelled Dodd frantically. However, after he had spoken, he realized the extent of the task. It was a mountain of large pieces, the smallest of which were far too heavy for Dodd to move on his own. "Wait here, I'm going for help," he said to the mound. He felt foolish after he'd spoken. The phrase "wait here" was ridiculous since the people who were trapped within had no alternative but to wait. Regardless, Dodd turned and ran back the way he had come, not feeling nearly as adventurous as before. While jogging up the road he had ridden down with Boot and Buck, Dodd found a bushy brown thicket of hercoil tangle shrubs and took the opportunity to conceal his sword. It was perfect timing, since shortly thereafter he bumped into three Drat soldiers patrolling the lane. "I found a collapse in the cave above the old dock," said Dodd, breathing heavy from running. "Some people are trapped inside, and the wreckage is big enough that it will take a dozen horses or hundreds of men to move it." "Did you see it happen?" asked one of the soldiers, looking at Dodd suspiciously. Another Drat with a shaggy beard and beady, distrustful eyes clutched the hilt of his blade and waited for Dodd's response. "No, but if we free the people inside, we'll know more," said Dodd, panting. He accompanied the soldiers to the Great Hall, where he found it was full. Despite the exodus, many remained at Twistyard enjoying Mercy's feast. It didn't take long before a group of nearly 200 men, equipped with candles and ropes, were following Dodd back to the cavern. All of the soldiers stationed at Twistyard went on highest alert, preparing for an attack. Uke dropped everything else on his lengthy, newly inherited list of duties to personally oversee the effort. As he followed Dodd to the rubble, he explained that the grotto had been used for a number of different purposes over the years, but lately had only served as a large closet for stockpiling emergency supplies. It was baffling to him why anyone would have interest in the location, which led him to believe that the debris had to have come from an accidental collapse. Once in the cave, many lit candles and the chatter of friendly companionship made Dodd feel better about the circumstance. He knew, as a team, they were going to save the trapped people. Everything felt right. As a matter of fact, Dodd became so inspired by the atmosphere of camaraderie that he almost told Uke about Czerny and Jib, though at the very moment when he opened his mouth to explain, something in the back of his mind stopped him. It was a murky feeling of uncertainty. "You were saying?" prodded Uke eagerly. He momentarily turned away from directing the affairs of the rescue to give Dodd his full attention, sensing Dodd was holding back important information. Dodd's insides ached to share his suspicions. He wanted to have as many people working on stopping Czerny and Jib as had been summoned to dig out the trapped people. "I was just going to say," said Dodd, stumbling along, "that it seems interesting that something like this would happen today." He fabricated on the fly a different answer to replace what he had almost shared. He silently hoped it was good enough to pass Uke's scrutiny. "You mean after Bombu's assassination?" asked Uke, urging Dodd to continue with his thought. "Yes, I guess that's what I mean," said Dodd haltingly, looking away from Uke's probing eyes. "It's a good thing that you happened upon this, isn't it?" said Uke, still waiting for Dodd to explain himself. "Now tell me, why were you down here instead of careening to Highgate?" For the first time in the discussion, Dodd realized that Uke suspected his involvement in the collapse was more than as a passerby. I thought this was a shortcut to the banquet," answered Dodd. It was the truth, even if it lacked his reason for being at the dock in the first place, rather than suiting up and heading to Commendus's engagement, as Uke had ordered him to do. "Everyone, take the line and pull," yelled a Drat soldier, who had accepted the responsibility of coordinating the manual labor. Dodd conveniently left the conversation with Uke where it was, and joined vigorously in pulling the giant rope. "Heave Paul! Heave Paul! Heave Paul!" called out the line of people who were drawing the cord, synchronizing their tugging efforts by chanting. Bit by bit, a colossal wooden post emerged from the rubble, knocking stone blocks around. After it completely dislodged, a cry of victory roared through the cave. "We have more where that came from," ordered the head soldier. "Tie the rope to another one." Dodd stole a glance over his shoulder and noticed Duke was still watching him. It was disconcerting. The rescue process continued for hours of heaving and pulling. When each object was removed from the pile, celebrating would ensue, followed by a moment of silence, listening to see if the captives were free. After 3 hours, Sonny appeared looking much nicer than she had earlier that morning and carrying a leather bag. "Mercy suggested you might be hungry," she said to Dodd. "Why don't you take a break and eat?" She pulled back the top flap and revealed a banquet feast in the satchel. It effectively tempted Dodd away from the rope. The smell alone was heaven sent. "Thanks, I'm famished," admitted Dodd, wiping his dirty hands on his pants. His arms trembled from fatigue and hunger. "So, what's happened here?" asked Sonny curiously. She appeared in much better spirits than before, and her face was less swollen. Dodd looked around at the crowd, especially Yuke, who buoyantly critiqued the effort while keeping his white gloves clean, and decided to take his lunch break outside. "We're still trying to figure it out," responded Dodd, after he and Sonny were out of the cave, and more importantly, out of the other people's hearing range. "Boot and Buck are tracking down Zerny and Jib. They went up the coast. I'm starting to get worried about them because they haven't returned yet." Sonny looked out at Lake Modge. The water stretched for as far as the eye could see, with a few islands dotting the shimmering glass like low-hanging clouds. She took a seat on the steps and turned back toward Dodd, who was still eyeing where Boot and Buck had disappeared, as if he expected them to materialize if only he gazed harder. "Do you really think all of this was caused by Zerny and Jib?" asked Sonny. She pulled Dodd's lunch out of the bag and arranged it next to her. He quickly plopped down and reached for the food. "Maybe," said Dodd, pausing to take a hungry bite of his steak and onion sandwich, followed by gulping a swig of grape juice. "They were down here this morning. That's a fact." Sonny looked nervous. "Regardless of who did this," she said, "Dilly's not trapped in there, is she? Have you seen her lately?" Dodd felt stupid. He hadn't remembered to tell Sonny of Dilly's message, even after promising. "She decided to accompany Sir Long to Highgate for the party," he began apologetically. "I meant to tell you earlier. And then this happened. They plan on honoring your grandpa tonight. Sir Long begged her, and she went along." "I thought she'd decide to go," said Sonny. "Sir Long's so persuasive." "You knew Sir Long wanted her to go?" sputtered Dodd, choking on his food. "Oh, yes," said Sonny, picking at Dodd's lunch until she settled on his dessert. She sampled a corner of the hand-sized blueberry tart and smiled sweetly. When Dodd continued to stare, pensively, she went on. "He woke us up early this morning, banging on our door and told us about Bombu. Then he tried to insist we go with him to Highgate."
"Really?"
"Yes. He was quite bent out of shape when Dilly said she wouldn't. He rubbed it in about his favor last night."
"What favor?"
asked Dodd, feeling his insides lurch uncomfortably. And it wasn't his lunch. "Sir Long twisted the rules to tell us what was going on, that Bombu was missing and that they were going to look for him. It was a secret." Dodd remembered there had been 5 riders at the barn the night before, and therefore asked eagerly, "Who went along?"
"Sir Long and Yuke and let's see," said Sonny, pausing to recall who else had gone.
While she was thinking, she stole another taste of his pastry. "There was one more. Who was it?" asked Dodd impatiently. His heart began to pound.
"Actually, there were 2, Tinja and Strat."
Dodd quieted down and ate his food as he thought the puzzle over.
Something wasn't right. 4 men had gone out looking for Bombu. However, only 3 of them had returned with Zerny and Jib. That left 1 of them missing.
"Hurrah!" rumbled from inside the cavern. Dodd and Sonny jumped up and ran to see what had happened. To everyone's great astonishment, Duchy came crawling out of a newly made breach in the mound. He was dirty, whiskery, and looked greatly disheveled.
"Duchy?" said Yuke, raising his eyebrows in amazement. "When did you get here?"
I don't know what you mean," said Duchy, scratching at his matted, filthy hair. He squinted as he surveyed the crowd of rescuers.
When did you return to Twistyard? Responded Yuke, dumbfounded, looking at Ducci like he was a ghost.
I never left, he said adamantly.
Yuke blinked in disbelief. I've been trapped in there for who knows how long, insisted Ducci, pointing at the remaining heap of rubble. It's been since whenever I disappeared. I've lost track.
Yuke's looks weren't the only ones that conveyed doubt, so Ducci explained, all the while holding back tears.
Days and nights jumble together when you're trapped alone like that. I mean, everybody, look at me.
His appearance was the most convincing piece of evidence he had. His clothes were worn ragged and grimy to the extent that they barely hung on him, and his pathetic, spotty facial hair clumped haphazardly like a molting chicken that just emerged from a dust bath, and his head was crowned with such a horrendous do that it would likely need to be shaved clean before hoping to grow anything worth leaving. And his eyes alone, nearly drugged with the fullest gamut of emotions, seemed to prove he was telling the truth. One Rawling, a tidy, sharp-dressed boy, rushed to Ducci's side and exclaimed, "I told them all you hadn't written the note. Your handwriting's far worse than that." He stayed a few paces back, not wanting to dirty himself, but appeared to care.
"Note?" asked Ducci. "What do you mean, Remy?"
"The note you supposedly left, telling us all you had quit the Kusing," said the boy, taking a step back. He could smell Ducci's poor hygiene.
"I wouldn't quit the Kusings," retorted Ducci, furrowing his brow. "Saab really stretched when he appointed me last year. My family, you know. We're not Choss or toting gold. It's taken me 15 years as a Rawling to earn my way in. What kind of sick person would prank a note like that?"
Ducci paused, then his face lit up. He knew what had happened.
"I have some important news for Pap," he exploded, talking so quickly that he fell over his own words. "Where is he?"
"Don't you know what happened to Pap?" asked Yuke, prodding more with his eyes than he did with his questions.
"No, they didn't, did they?" blurted Ducci, looking devastated. "Was Pap poisoned?"
"He was," said Yuke, approaching the trembling boy. "What do you know of it?" The smaller conversations in the cavern went silent. Remy and the other rescuers looked spellbound, hanging on Ducci's every word.
"I was exploring down here one night, after curfew," confessed Ducci, not afraid to face Yuke squarely. "And you may punish me as much as you want for doing it. But while I was in here, searching among the supplies, I overheard mumbled parts of a conversation. At length, I realized two or three men were discussing how to poison Pap. They had already tried twice and failed. It startled me to hear it, and unfortunately, I bumped a rack of metal hitches to the ground. When the men came running, I hid in the back of this hall under a pile of blankets on a shelf."
"Were you alone?" asked Yuke.
"Yes. It has been driving me crazy. I lay still under the blankets until a crashing sound shook the hall, and when I finally dared to crawl out, the corridor was pitch black, and the air was filled with dust. I was trapped."
"And you survived all this time?" replied Yuke with a heavy dose of skepticism in his voice. Even if he believed the boy, he was going to make him earn his clemency.
"I certainly did," said Ducci, nodding his head and gazing about the crowd of mesmerized listeners. "The hall's probably 300 feet deep, 30 feet wide, 15 feet high, and lined with survival supplies on every shelf. I'm physically fine. It's my brain that's nearly bonkers. And 10 lifetimes from now is too soon to drink apple juice or chew a beef strip again."
Ducci leaned in close enough to wrap Yuke on the shoulder and added bravely, "Bamboo should look into a bit of variety with the supplies." The cave rumbled with subdued chuckles.
"Right," said Yuke slowly. He searched for any signs of intentional deception.
"So, tell me what happened to Pap," asked Ducci. "Did you catch them?"
"He was poisoned while en route to Sush," said Yuke, backing away from Ducci as Remy had done.
Dodd and Sonny stared in horror. Ducci had never gone home,
which made Sir Lonk a big liar.
Yuke continued to question Ducci, with the crowd watching intently, but not Dodd. He bent over and studied the ground, fearing he was possibly about to retch. He didn't want to hear or see the truth, not after personally instigating Dilly's trip to Highgate. However, the clues were staring him in the face. Half buried in the rubble right between Dodd's legs was a shiny button bearing Sir Lonk's family insignia.
"Sir Lonk," whispered Dodd to Sonny. He groaned while holding the proof in his hand. "Dilly's in danger. We need to warn her."
The rescuers were so driven by their curiosity for Ducci's comments that they didn't even notice when Sonny and Dodd moved to leave, including Yuke.
Once again, Dodd wanted to get other people involved, and Sonny certainly did too, but a muggy, suffocating feeling set in the moment they tried, which sent them racing away to solve the problem on their own. I guess Pap was wrong about his suspicions. Unless Zerny and Jib are working with Sir Long, said Dodd. Why do you say that? Puffed Sonny, trying to keep up as they ran. He wrote a note, and it mentioned the Dread having a son, possibly working with him. Sir Long has a son, said Sonny, her light brown curls bouncing with each leap. Not at Twistyard, said Dodd confidently, keeping the fast pace. Yes, he does. Taunus. Dodd glanced sideways, shocked. You're kidding me. Taunus is Sir Long's son? Yep, said Sonny, puffing heavier. You'd never guess by the way Taunus acts. He's probably the only decent occupant of Rahl Hall I can think of. Of course, Ducci's had a good enough shakedown that he may be nicer now, assuming Saab lets him back in. Dodd slowed his pace to a jog and then stopped. He looked up at the sun, high in the sky, and frustration filled his eyes. We've already missed the dropping of the barrier, haven't we? Groaned Dodd. I'm afraid so, said Sonny, doubling over to catch her breath. But that's not exactly the end of it, she added, peering up at Dodd, who was also winded. He grimaced and stretched like a runner who had just lost a race. What do you mean? He asked, coughing to clear his dry throat. Well, there's always an exception to rules, said Sonny, holding back a smirk. The way she said it proved she was Dilly's sister. I happen to know of an exception created for dropping the barrier, she continued, matter-of-factly. I read over it once with Bamboo. Dodd looked at Sonny with hopeful eyes. I can't guarantee anything, Sonny added quickly. It may not work for us, and even if it does, they could throw us in jail for doing it. That sounds exciting, said Dodd. Incarceration was preferred to the mental agony he was stewing in over accidentally sending Dilly off with the Dread. The guilt was written on his face and ate at his insides. He couldn't imagine thinking of anything else until Dilly was safe. If we dong the waiting bell and signal properly with mirrors, said Sonny, looking into the air, the guards have instructions to do an emergency dropping of the barrier, unless other circumstances prevent them. But we'll still need to make it before the sun sets. We can do that, said Dodd. Of course, only Bamboo should be signaling, said Sonny cringingly. Which he won't be. But I am his great-granddaughter. I could tell them that I have an urgent message for Commendus, and once I've informed him of Dilly's danger, even if they had to lock us up, Commendus could stop Sir Lonk. Don't forget I'm a specially invited guest at Commendus's palace for tonight's honor banquet, said Dodd, beaming. That should make the guards listen to us. If we're dressed the part and I show them my invitation, don't you think they'd let us in? It's at least worth a shot, urged Sonny, gulping. If Sir Lonk is the Dread. Oh, he is. I'm sure of it now, interrupted Dodd. A few minutes ago you said it was Zerny, replied Sonny, still holding some doubt. I know, and maybe he and Jib are somehow involved, but Sir Lonk had to be the instigator of Ducci's trapping. I've got his button right here. Dodd held it up. This implicates him in Pap's poisoning, which means he... And he totally lied to us about talking with Ducci, blurted Sonny, beginning to get hot in the head. Not to mention, lying does seem to be a theme with Sir Lonk. After all, he had no problem breaking his word last night to provide me and Dilly with the latest news on Bamboo's circumstance. He's evil. I've sensed it all along, said Dodd. You have not, snapped Sonny, shoving him off the trail into a gazandra bush. The needled branches looked prickly, but were softer than pine. Yes, I have, insisted Dodd, crawling out. At least Sir Lonk seems to fancy Dilly, said Sonny gingerly, poking her foot at a slumping, grayish weed. She was trying to stay positive. I don't think he would hurt her. Did you think he would poison Pap or kill Bamboo, blurted Dodd. He's already acquired Higgis half of the map to Bamboo's secrets, and he still needs Dilly's. What are the chances of her giving it up without a fight? None if she's still breathing, groaned Sonny anxiously. Dodd and Sonny picked up their pace, hurrying to retrieve Dodd's sword and suit, and to find mirrors to signal with and a horse to borrow. They flew through the first three items, but the fourth was practically impossible. Nobody's horse remained at Twistyard. In total, over 900 of them had left for Highgate that morning, most of which were temporarily taken to pull carriages. With little time to spare, Dodd suggested they stop asking for permission and start searching the barns. Even if there's only one horse remaining, he said confidently, we'll take it. Dilly's life is at stake. The first four barns Dodd and Sonny looked in were completely empty, as were a half dozen fenced fields that usually brimmed with mares. It was disheartening. The rejections from everyone had been honest excuses, for all of the horses were gone. Dodd reassured Sonny that the last barn would have at least one. He knew it. Twistyard wouldn't sit without a messenger horse. It would be too imprudent. However, shockingly, the final stalls were as empty as the others in the previous barns. "This is outrageous," said Dodd in frustration. He walked over to the stall where Dilly usually kept Song and flopped down on the soft straw in the back. "I can't believe all of the horses are gone. It's crazy. It makes you wonder what might be coming. How long would the Drap forces last against an assault without being able to send for reinforcements? Why would Uke allow it?" "Maybe he's involved," offered Sonny. She was starting to tear up, and logically so, for it seemed everyone in the world was out to get them. "Wait, that's it. Would you give up his favorite horse?" said Dodd, remembering the treachery of Coyote Trail. "Last time he loaned her out, things didn't go very well. If he were trying to hide her, make sure no one would touch her, where would he put her?" Sonny thought for a minute, then led Dodd toward the little overgrown field hidden by trees where Uke had kept his mare out to pasture the night before. It appeared deserted. The bushes, weeds, and young trees towered 12 feet in many places, making a thorough search impossible from the fence line. Dodd and Sonny split up and scoured the brush, jogging from one open pocket to the next. The pasture had been abandoned for long enough that it appeared more wild than fallow. Finally, Dodd let out a cry. "Over here!" he yelled with excitement. "Come over here! You're brilliant, Sonny! You're brilliant!" In the middle of the thickets, a half acre of grazed grass was inhabited by two horses, each loosely tied, giving them freedom to roam just far enough to eat. One of them was Uke's favorite mare, and the other was Shooter. "We'll leave Brown Sugar," said Dodd, thinking about his nasty experience climbing Coyote Trail. "Let's ride double on Shooter. He's strong enough to get us to Highgate before the sun sets." In a flash, the horse was saddled, and the duo set off running. Nothing could stop them, not even the 7 Drat soldiers that saw them riding and ordered they halt, suspecting the horse was illicitly borrowed. Every shortcut was employed to reduce riding time, even the dreaded Coyote Trail. They recognized that each minute drew the sun further across the sky, reducing their chances of successfully bringing the Tri-Blot barrier down. When Dodd and Sonny finally arrived at the entry to Highgate, it was like finishing a horse race after the crowd had gone home. Where mobs of people had waited to get in the first time Dodd had been there, only a lonely sparrow hopped about, eating pieces of wheat that someone's load had leaked under a scorching noonday sun. Now, the sky was different. Across the distant horizon, faint clouds turned red and orange. Only half of the sun was still casting rays, the other half hid behind a mountain. "At least it's over there," said Sonny, trying to build up enough courage to follow through. "For much of the year, it sets directly behind that larger string of mountains. If it had today, it would already be too late." "Let's do it," said Dodd, dismounting Shooter and walking over to the giant bell. "Now how do I dong it?" Sonny pointed at a large stick with a leather clump secured to the end. It hung 6 feet up a post and was covered with dust. From every indication, it had never been used. "All right, I feel privileged," said Dodd, his heart pounding rapidly. He drew the rod down and positioned to strike. Just then, an elementary school memory entered his mind. It made him sweat. In 4th grade, Cole had been blamed for pulling the fire alarm, which he hadn't done, and had narrowly dodged getting expelled for it. Now, holding the special stick and ready to trigger a real alarm of sorts, Dodd felt the embarrassment all over again. "Here's to Dilly," he said, striking the bell firmly 3 times. Sonny nudged Shooter into the middle of the road and pulled out 2 mirrors. She flashed them back and forth, catching the light with one and sending it in the direction of Highgate with the other, hoping the last rays of the sunshine would still convince the soldiers to react positively. Nothing happened. Dodd struck the bell 3 times again, which was followed by Sonny's systematic flashing with the mirrors. It was all in accordance with the regulations, yet still nothing happened. One last time, Dodd and Sonny repeated their procedure. However, the only thing that responded was the sun. It finally set. And since rays were no longer able to reach the mirrors, trying again wasn't an option. "We did our best," mumbled Dodd. He hung the stick in place and joined Sonny on the back of Shooter. Together, they waited quietly for what seemed like an eternity. About 5 minutes. "I guess it didn't work," admitted Sonny, her voice quivering. I'm sorry I dragged you into this.
No, I think it's the other way around, said Dodd, trying to swallow tears. They had given it everything and failed.
Dong! The distant pavilion's bell rang out. Dong, 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 dong.
It's working, cried Sonny. We did it. It's really working.
The bells pealed from one tower to the next, just as they had the first time Dodd visited Highgate, though some of the towers took longer to respond. It was the most wonderful music, not because of their sound, but because of what they represented. When the process was over, Dodd and Sonny knew it for certain by the approach of a troop of soldiers who stormed the wide road and headed to meet them.
I hope they let us enter, winced Sonny, realizing the moment of truth was quickly nearing. She liked her theory of entry as a topic of discussion. Actually following through with it was scary.
I'm sure everything's going to work out just fine, said Dodd, not very convincingly.
If you were them, you'd send soldiers to greet us, wouldn't you? Besides, they could have ignored us if they didn't plan on helping us, right?
Dodd attempted to reassure Sonny, but most of his statements ended in questions. He, too, dreaded the approaching confrontation and had plenty of doubts.
What's your business and who ordered this? Demanded a large Treader soldier.
He was well decorated with medals and marks of commendation, indicating he was a battle-tested general. Obviously, he was in charge of the other 50 men who rode with him, and probably the 300 that waited on horseback by the entrance to Highgate.
We did, sir, under the seal of Bombu Tilia, said Dodd confidently.
That's impossible. You'll need to come with us, said the general stiffly. He glowed reddish-purple with agitation at having been summoned to great lengths needlessly.
Men, surround them!
Hold on, we're telling the truth, pleaded Dodd. He didn't sound as confident anymore. This is his great-granddaughter, Sonny Tilius, from Twistyard. She bears an important message which is only for the ears of Commendus.
And you couldn't wait until tomorrow? Asked the incensed commander. He scowled angrily.
I doubt you're truthful, he grumbled, raising one hand in the air while ordering.
Men, take them to the binding hall for interrogation, and if they resist your assistance, kill them.
Why would we lie to you, sir? Begged Dodd. He felt the pressure of two horses pushing on either side of Shooter, mounted by men with drawn swords.
Don't you think we knew the seriousness of requesting a special dropping of the barrier? And yet we did it anyway, to be faithful to our charge.
Then what message does the girl bring? Barked the general. He was beyond furious, calculating the thousands of men that were affected, currently waiting at attention in towers and holds all around Highgate, with swords and spears and bows ready for an ambush, all unnecessarily working so two very simple-looking people could make an evening entry.
I'll be the judge of whether it's worthy of the mountainous trouble you've caused, said the chief officer, glaring coldly.
Royal feelings flooded over Dodd like a wave overtaking the beach. He could see Pap in his mind, standing for truth, holding the very sword that was now stowed in a sheath attached to his waist.
Sir, Dodd insisted in a regal voice, commanding everyone's full attention. I am the grandson of Pap, the very hero who was murdered within your walls. I carry a sword at my side, and am by virtue of my own acts, as much as by blood, his rightful descent. The lady has a message for Commendus, and him alone. If you were to hear it, I would need to dispose of you forthwith. That is my charge.
Outrageous! Yelled the commander, his treader ring pulsating with blood. You're nothing but a common boy. His fingers fidgeted with the silver and brass handle of his sword, as though he desperately wanted to end the argument with his blade. But Dodd didn't back down.
See us through, he said courageously.
Not tonight, said the general, who was working to stay in control of his temper. Commendus will hear of you tomorrow, when I personally tell him of your ludicrous claims.
Then perhaps at the same time you may explain to him this as well, for I am confident he will request your rationale.
Dodd drew the invitation from his suit pocket and held it up for the men to see. I delayed my coming in order to protect Sonny.
Is that authentic? Asked one of the soldiers who was close enough to read the invitation.
Regardless, his weapon is familiar, blurted a different soldier in a gruff voice. He pointed at Dodd's sword from Pap. I recognize the insignia on the handle. It's Pap's all right. And his sheath bears the name Bombu Tilius. He must be Pap's grandson, as he says.
Sonny beamed, grateful she had borrowed a sheath from Dilly's collection that bore her grandfather's noble name.
The general's face cringed noticeably when he drew his horse close enough to read Dud's invitation from Commendus. "You're Pap's grandson," he said, forcing an apologetic tone. "You're the one who helped Triticella recover our tribe lot, right?"
"Yes, I am," said Dodd, nodding.
"I'm terribly sorry that I didn't recognize you," said the commander, still red-faced but submissive. The words burned like fire on his tongue as he awkwardly made excuses for his behavior. "Perhaps the night air has affected my eyes," he stumbled, "and my temper, too. And with all the trouble we've seen lately here at Highgate, everyone's concerned about suspicious behavior." Dodd continued to stare, unbendingly, until the general finally confessed in a tortured voice, "Please, forgive me and my men for our ignorance. We'll step aside." The man nudged his horse, and all of his men quickly followed. "Oh, and accept my personal condolences," the commander called out, this time sounding almost genuine. "Pap was the greatest of men. And Bombu, too."
"Thank you," said Dodd pretentiously. "Very well, then. We'll be on our way."
He felt snobbish with his response and posture, but he didn't dare act his normal self, for he feared the tide of doubt would return to the soldiers, and they would have another go at him. Once in Highgate, Dodd and Sonny rode as fast as they could to Commendus's estate. Something inside them cried out that Sir Lonk was making a move on Dilly. And unfortunately, that foreboding something was right.